was too full for anyone to start any trouble. As I drew closer, I could see the two men more clearly. The elder of the two was a grey-haired gentleman in his mid-70s. He had large mutton-chop sideburns and was dressed in a neat tweed suit with a silk bow tie. His hands were holding a pair of brown gloves on top of his walking stick, and I could see a deerstalker hat on the seat next to him. His face had a ruddy appearance, and as I approached he threw back his head and laughed like a seal at something the younger man had said. The man opposite him was aged about 30. He sat on the front of his seat in a slightly nervous manner. He sipped at a tonic water and wore a pinstripe suit that was expensive but had seen better days. I knew I had seen him before somewhere, but couldn't think where.
"You gentlemen looking for me?"
They both got up together. The elder of the two spoke first. "Miss Next, delighted to make your acquaintance. The name's Analogy. Victor Analogy, head of Swindon Literatex. We spoke on the phone." He offered his hand and I shook it. "Pleased to meet you, sir." "This is Operative Bowden Cable. You'll be working together."
"I am very pleased to make your acquaintance, madam," said Bowden, quite grandly, slightly awkwardly, and very stiffly.
"Have we met before?"
I asked, shaking his outstretched hand.
"No," said Bowden firmly. "I would have remembered."
Victor offered me a seat next to Bowden, who shuffled up, making polite noises. I took a sip of my drink. It tasted like old horse blankets soaked in urine. I coughed explosively. Bowden offered me his handkerchief.
"Vorpal Special," said Victor, raising an eyebrow. "Brave girl."
Thank you.
"Welcome to Swindon," continued Victor.
"First of all, I'd like to say how sorry we were to hear about your little incident. By all accounts, Hades was a monster. I'm not sorry he died. I hope you are quite recovered."
"I am, but others were not so fortunate."
"I'm sorry to hear that, but you are very welcome here. No one of your caliber has ever bothered to join us in this backwater before."
I looked at Analogy and was slightly puzzled.
"I'm not sure I understand what you're driving at."
"What I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, is all of us in the office are more academics than typical spec-op agents. Your post was held by Jim Cromarty. He was shot dead in the old town during a book-buy that went wrong. He was Bowden's partner. Jim was a very special friend to us all. He had a wife, 3 kids. I want very badly the person who took Cromarty from us."
I stared at their earnest faces with some confusion until the penny dropped. They thought I was a full and pucker SO5 operative on a rest and recuperation assignment. It wasn't unusual. Back at SO27 we used to get worn-out characters from SO9 and SO7 all the time. Without exception, they had all been mad as pants.
"You've read my file?"
I asked slowly.
"They wouldn't release it," replied Analogy. "It's not often we get an operative moving to our little band from the dizzy heights of Spec Ops 5. We needed a replacement with good field experience, but also someone who can... well, how shall I put it?"
Analogy paused, apparently at a loss for words. Bowden answered for him.
"We need someone who isn't frightened to use extreme force if deemed necessary."
I looked at them both, wondering whether it would be better to come clean. After all, the only thing I had shot recently was my own car and a seemingly bulletproof master criminal. I was officially SO27, not SO5. But with the strong possibility of Acheron still being around and revenge still high on my agenda, perhaps it would be better to play along.
Analogy shuffled nervously. "Cromarty's murder is being looked after by Homicide, of course. Unofficially, we can't do a great deal, but Spec Ops has always prided itself on a certain independence. If we uncovered any evidence in the pursuit of other inquiries, it would not be frowned upon. Do you understand?"
"Sure.
Do you have any idea who killed Cromarty?"
Someone said that they had something for him to see, to buy. A rare Dickens manuscript. He went to see it and, well, he wasn't armed, you know.
Few literatecs in Swindon even know how to use a firearm, added Bowden, and training for many of them is out of the question. Literary detection and firearms don't really go hand in hand, pen mightier than the sword, and so forth.
Words are all very well, I replied coolly, suddenly enjoying the SO5 woman of mystery stuff, but a 9mm really gets to the root of the problem. They stared at me in silence for a second or two. Victor drew out a photograph from a buff envelope and placed it on the table in front of me.
"We'd like your opinion on this. It was taken yesterday."
I looked at the photo. I knew the face well enough.
"Jack Shit."
"And what do you know about him?"
"Not much. He's head of Goliath's internal security service. He wanted to know what Hades had planned to do with the Chuzzlewit manuscript."
"I'll let you into a secret. You're right that Shit's Goliath, but he's not internal security."
"What then?"
"Advanced Weapons Division. 8 billion annual budget, and it all goes through him."
8 billion?
"And loose change. Rumour has it they even went over that budget to develop the plasma rifle. He's intelligent, ambitious, and quite inflexible. He came here 2 weeks ago. He wouldn't be in Swindon at all unless there was something here that Goliath found of great interest. We think Cromarty went to see the original manuscript of Chuzzlewit, and if that is so..."
"Shit is here because I am," I announced suddenly. "He thought it suspicious that I should want an SO27 job in Swindon, of all places. No offence meant."
"None taken," replied Analogy. "But Shit being here makes me think that Hades is still about, or at the very least Goliath thinks so."
"I know," I replied. "Worrying, isn't it?" Analogy and Cable looked at one another. They had made the points they wanted to make. I was welcome here, they were keen to avenge Cromarty's death, and they didn't like Jack Shit. They wished me a pleasant evening, donned their hats and coats, and were gone.
The jazz number came to an end. I joined in the applause as Holroyd got shakily to his feet and waved at the crowd before leaving. The bar thinned out rapidly once the music had finished, leaving me almost alone. I looked to my right, where two Miltons were busy making eyes at one another, and then at the bar, where several suited business reps were drinking as much as they could on their overnight allowance. I walked over to the piano and sat down. I struck a few chords, testing my arm at first, then becoming more adventurous as I played the lower half of a duet I remembered. I looked at the barman to order another drink, but he was busy drying a glass. As the intro for the top part of the duet came round for the third time, a man's hand reached in and played the first note of the upper part exactly on time. I closed my eyes. I knew who it was instantly, but I wasn't going to look up. I could smell his aftershave and noticed the scar on his left hand. The hair on the back of my neck bristled slightly, and I felt a flush rise within me. I instinctively moved to the left and let him sit down. His fingers drifted across the keys with mine, the two of us playing together almost flawlessly. The barman looked on approvingly, and even the suited salesman stopped talking and looked around to see who was playing. Still, I did not look up. As my hands grew more accustomed to that long unplayed tune, I grew confident and played faster. My unwatched partner kept up the tempo to match me. We played like this for perhaps 10 minutes, but I couldn't bring myself to look at him. I knew that if I did, I would smile, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted him to know I was still pissed off. Then he could charm me. When the piece finally came to an end, I continued to stare ahead. The man next to me didn't move.
"Hello, Landon," I said finally.
"Hello, Thursday."
I played a couple of notes absently, but still didn't look up.
"It's been a long time," I said.
"A lot of water under the bridge," he replied.
10 years' worth. His voice sounded the same. The warmth and sensitivity I had once known so well were still there. I looked up at him, caught his gaze, and looked away quickly. I had felt my eyes moisten. I was embarrassed by my feelings and scratched my nose nervously. He had gone slightly grey, but he wore his hair in much the same manner. There were slight wrinkles around his eyes, but they might just as easily have been from laughing as from age. He was 30 when I walked out. I had been 26. I wondered whether I had aged as well as he had. Was I too old to still hold a grudge? After all, getting into a strop with Landon wasn't going to bring Anton back. I felt an urge to ask him if it was too late to try again, but as I opened my mouth, the world juddered to a halt. The D-sharp I had just pressed kept on sounding, and Landon stared at me, his eyes frozen in mid-blink. Dad's timing could not have been worse.
"Hello, sweet pea," he said, walking up to me out of the shadows. "Am I disturbing anything?"
"Most definitely yes."
"I won't be long, then. What do you make of this?"
He handed me a yellow, curved thing, about the size of a large carrot.
"What is it?"
I asked, smelling it cautiously.
"It's the fruit of a new plant designed completely from scratch 70 years from now. Look."
He peeled the skin off and let me taste it.
"Good, eh? You can pick it well before ripe. Transport it thousands of miles if necessary, and it will keep fresh in its own hermetically sealed biodegradable packaging. Nutritious and tasty, too. It was sequenced by a brilliant engineer named Anna Bannon. We're a bit lost as to what to call it. Any ideas?"
"I'm sure you'll think of something. What are you going to do with it?"
"I thought I'd introduce it somewhere in the 10th millennium, before the present one. See how it goes. Food for mankind, that sort of thing. Well, time waits for no man, as we say. I'll let you get back to Landon."
The world flickered and started up again. Landon opened his eyes and stared at me.
"Banana,"
I said, suddenly realising what it was that my father had shown me.
"Pardon?"
"Banana. They named it after the designer."
"Thursday, you're making no sense at all," said Landon with a bemused grin.
"My dad was just here."
"Ah, is he still of all time?"
"Still the same. Listen, I'm sorry about what happened."
"Me too," replied Landon, then lapsed into silence. I wanted to touch his face, but I said instead,
"I missed you."
It was the wrong thing to say, and I cursed myself. Too much, too soon. Landon shuffled uneasily. "You should take aim more carefully. I missed you a lot, too. The first year was the worst."
Landon paused for a moment. He played a few notes on the piano and then said,
"I have a life, and I like it here. Sometimes I think that Thursday Next was just a character from one of my novels, someone I made up in the image of the woman I wanted to love. Now, well, I'm over it." It wasn't really what I was hoping to hear, but after all that had happened, I couldn't blame him.
"But you came to find me."
Landon smiled at me. "You're in my town, Thurs. When a friend comes in from out of town, you look them up. Isn't that how it's supposed to work?"
"And you buy them flowers? Does Colonel Phelps get roses too?"
"No, he gets lilies. Old habits die hard."
"I see. You've been doing well for yourself."
"Thanks," he replied. "You never answered my letters."
"I never read your letters."
"Are you married?"
"I can't see that's any of your business."
"I'll take that as a no." The conversation had taken a turn for the worse. It was time to bail out.
"Listen, I'm bushed, Landon. I have a very big day ahead of me." I got up. Landon limped after me. He had lost a leg in the Crimea, but he was well used to it by now. He caught up with me at the bar.
"Dinner one night?"
I turned to face him.
"Sure. Tuesday?"
"Why not?"
"Good," said Landon, rubbing his hands. "We could get the old unit back together."
This wasn't what I had in mind. Hang on. Tuesday's not very good after all.